Imagine standing at a high-security military checkpoint in a conflict zone. You're watching vehicles roll through, tensions are incredibly high, and, you know, the threat of hidden explosives is just a constant reality.
Right. It's a terrifying high-stakes environment for anyone to be in.
Exactly. But to maintain safety, the guards don't pull out ground-penetrating radar or, like, thermal imaging, not even trained sniffer dogs. Instead, a guard pulls out a plastic handle with a freely swinging metal antenna attached to the end.
Yeah, just a piece of plastic and metal.
Right, and he points it at a passing truck and literally just waits for the antenna to magically cross over to indicate a bomb.
Which is, I mean, it's wild. It sounds like a scene from some dystopian satire.
It really does. But this was a terrifying real-world scenario playing out as recently as 2016. Because the technology they were relying on wasn't, well, it wasn't technology at all. It was a modern plastic reincarnation of a 16th century magic trick.
And that's because the human mind just possesses this incredible capacity to deceive itself. Especially when the stakes are literally life and death. You know, that desire for a simple, visible answer in a chaotic world can just completely override centuries of scientific advancement.
Welcome to a new deep dive. Today, we're focusing on a centuries-old, highly controversial, and strangely enduring practice known as dowsing. You might also know it as water divining, or doodlebugging, or water witching.
Yeah, doodlebugging is such a funny term for it, but the history is actually incredibly dark and complex.
Totally. The source material for this exploration is a comprehensive Wikipedia article detailing the historical origins of dowsing, the surprisingly specific physical equipment involved, the rigorous scientific evaluations designed to test it, and, as we mentioned, the alarming modern applications that have infiltrated major institutions.
So our mission today is to trace the lineage of this practice. We really want to understand how something once explicitly condemned by major religious institutions as occultism not only survived into the modern era, but, like, actively thrived.
And it requires unpacking the fascinating psychological quirks that make the practice feel undeniably real to the person holding the stick. Plus, examining the high-stakes consequences that unfold when institutions mistake human psychology for physics. Okay, let's unpack this. Because tracking how a piece of wood eventually became a piece of tactical military gear means going back to the very beginning.
Right, and those origins, they don't lie in a scientific laboratory. They start deep inside the treacherous, pitch-black, mountainous regions of 16th century Germany.
Yeah, Georges Agricola's 1556 book, De Re Metallica, it paints this really vivid picture. You have German miners wandering through these incredibly dangerous environments, their fists just clenched tightly around forked twigs.
Just waiting in the dark.
Exactly, waiting for the wood to spontaneously twist and point them toward hidden veins of metal ore.
And that German mining culture is the exact birthplace of the terminology we still use today.
Yeah.
So in Middle Low German, this forked stick was called a Schlagrut.
Which translates to what? Striking rod?
Literally striking rod, yeah. And during that era, German deep mining technology was basically the most advanced in the world. So when those miners migrated to England to work in the tin mines of Cornwall and Devon, they naturally brought their striking rods with them.
Oh, that makes sense. A kind of technological transfer, even if the tech was just a twig.
Exactly. And the local Cornish dialect eventually morphed that German concept into the word duschen, meaning to strike, which then softened into the English word we use today, which is douse.
Douse. Wow. But the spread of this practice wasn't exactly celebrated by everyone, right? I mean, it was incredibly polarized.
Oh, massively. It drew the fury of some of the most powerful figures in history.
Like Martin Luther.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
In 1518, the Protestant reformer Martin Luther actually issued an explicit ban on dowsing for metals.
Because he thought it was a scam.
No, not a scam. He didn't view it as a harmless superstition at all. He categorized it as a direct breach of the First Commandment.
Oh, wow. So he took it very seriously.
Very. To Luther, relying on a twitching stick was relying on unseen demonic forces. It was pure occultism.
And he wasn't the only one. The religious opposition was fierce. There was a 1662 decree by a Jesuit scholar, Gaspar Schott, who declared divining with rods to be blatantly satanic.
Yeah, and the stakes of using this tool escalated dramatically a bit later in 17th century France, because suddenly, dowsing was no longer just being used to find underground silver or water.
Right. The sources say it was being deported by authorities to track down criminals and hunt heretics.
Which is terrifying. The potential for horrific abuse was so glaring that the Inquisition itself intervened. In 1701, they issued a formal decree forbidding the use of dousing for any purposes of justice.
But here is what I find so weird. At the exact same time the Inquisition is banning it, other religious figures are recording dousing as a divine miracle.
Oh, right. The St. Teresa story.
Yeah. The source material highlights this bizarre anomaly from 1568. So St. Teresa of Spain was offered a barren plot of land for a new convent, but the site was entirely without water.
Which is a deal breaker.
Obviously. But then, out of nowhere, a friar named Antonio arrives at the twig. He paces the ground, makes some sweeping movements, and St. Teresa later noted she wasn't sure if he was making the sign of the cross or just waving the stick, and he suddenly halts, points to the dirt, and commands them to dig.
And they actually find water.
They strike a copious, unending fount of water. And St. Teresa, completely unfamiliar with this German mining trick, assumes she has just witnessed a literal miracle handed down by God.
It's so fascinating. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, survival and extreme need will always outpace theological debates.
What do you mean?
Well, German miners brought the striking rod to England because failing to find tin meant starvation. English settlers carry the practice to the American frontier because establishing a homestead in the Dakota Territory required water.
Right, and digging a dry well out there could literally cost a family their lives.
Exactly. When human survival is on the line, pragmatic results or even just the illusion of control take precedence over what Martin Luther thought in 1518. Necessity just breeds this profound tolerance for the inexplicable.
So, okay, how did a practice so heavily condemned as satanic witchcraft become a completely normalized practical tool for those homesteaders? I mean, what are the actual mechanics of the tools they were using?
Well, if you're staking your life on a piece of wood, the physical design of that tool becomes incredibly important. The arsenal of divination is actually surprisingly specific.
Right, it's not just any stick you pick up off the ground.
No, the iconic tool, the one etched into our cultural imagination, is the Y-shaped twig. Practitioners historically mandate that it be freshly cut from a tree, ensuring the wood is flexible and alive.
And the type of wood matters too, right?
Yeah, the preferred species changes depending on the local flora. European dowsers traditionally seek out hazel twigs. But in the U.S., practitioners often carve their rods from witch hazels, willow, or peach trees.
But the technique for holding this twig is not a relaxed grip. The dowser takes the two forked ends, one in each hand, with the main stem pointing straight ahead.
Right, and they clench their fists really tightly.
Tightly, turning their wrists so their thumbs are pointing outward. And that puts the entire branch under immense physical tension. Then they walk slowly, just waiting for the stem to violently dip or twitch.
And as the practice evolved, the equipment evolved too.
Yeah.
The modern era introduced those L-shaped metal rods.
Like bent coat hangers.
Yeah, often literally made from wire coat hangers or utility flags. A dowser holds one in each hand by the short arm of the L, keeping them completely upright.
But they want them to swing freely, right?
Exactly. So to remove friction from the equation, these metal rods are often placed inside hollow tubes. As the practitioner walks over a target, the rods will theoretically swing outward, away from each other, or cross inward to form an X.
And some people just use a simple pendulum, too, holding a small weight suspended on a short cord and, you know, interpreting the direction of its swing.
Which naturally leads to people trying to explain why these things move.
Mm-hmm.
Because the natural human urge to rationalize the bizarre led to some pretty wild scientific theories in the 18th century.
Oh, like William Price in 1778.
Yes. He published this highly detailed theory attempting to map Enlightenment-era physics onto this practice. He proposed the existence of something called effluvia.
Effluvia? Like a gas?
Kind of. The idea was that underground minerals or water sources emitted invisible vapors or physical particles that rose straight up through the soil.
And those particles somehow move the wood?
Yeah, the theory was that when these particles hit the porous, freshly cut wood of the dowsing rod, they physically entered the grain of the wood, literally forcing the branch to bow downward to align with the vertical column of vapor.
I mean, he was trying to be logical. He was observing a real phenomenon. The stick was undeniably moving and attempting to construct a rational external cause for it.
Because the movement felt entirely separate from the dowser's conscious intention. So the assumption was that an invisible external force had to be responsible.
Think about balancing a broom straight up on the palm of your hand. Have you ever tried to do that?
Oh, yeah. You look ridiculous doing it.
Right, because keeping that broom upright requires constant, frantic micro-adjustments from your arm and shoulder muscles. It is a state of highly unstable equilibrium.
That's a great analogy.
Well, when a dowser twists a fresh, springy Y-branch into a state of massive tension, or holds two frictionless L-rods upright in metal tubes, aren't they deliberately creating an incredibly unstable physical environment? I mean, is the design of the tool just meant to amplify tiny accidental movements?
Yes. That physical instability is the entire engine of the practice. The scientific community universally recognizes dowsing as a pseudoscience, and the actual mechanism driving the movement of the rod is a well-documented psychological trait.
Which is called the ideomotor phenomenon, right?
Exactly, the ghost in the machine. Unpacking the psychology here reveals something incredible about how the human brain partitions information.
Okay, break that down for us, because if it's just random chance, why do dowsers swear by it so fiercely? The rod moving feels like a violent external force to them. How can our brains essentially hijack our own hands without us realizing it?
Well, what's fascinating here is that the ideomotor phenomenon allows the subconscious mind to dictate physical movement without the conscious mind ever giving permission. Yeah, the brain is constantly processing an ocean of environmental data that the conscious mind just ignores. So a dowser walking a field might subconsciously register a subtle depression in the topography, or maybe a sudden patch of deeply green vegetation.
Or a change in the soil that suggests water.
Precisely. The subconscious mind processes that clue and sends a microscopic electrical impulse to the muscles in the arms and hands.
And because the dowser is holding that stick under immense physical tension, trying desperately to keep it perfectly still, that microscopic muscle twitch acts like a trigger on a loaded spring.
Exactly. The tension releases and the rod snaps downward.
And to the dowser, whose conscious mind was completely unaware of the muscle twitch, that sudden violent release of energy feels like an external force ripping the stick toward the ground.
I mean, it can be so violent it literally strips the bark off the branch.
That's insane. And that visceral physical feedback must be incredibly convincing.
Oh, it is. Combine that ideomotor snap with standard confirmation bias and a deeply entrenched belief system forms. If a dowser is walking over favorable terrain with a uniform water table, digging a hole almost anywhere will yield water.
Oh, so they're basically guaranteed to hit water anyway.
In certain areas, yes. And when they find water where the stick pointed, the belief is cemented forever. The hits are remembered as absolute proof, and the misses are easily rationalized away as human error or, you know, a blocked underground string.
But because that internal physical conviction is so overwhelming for the practitioner, merely explaining the psychology was never going to convince anyone.
Never.
So the scientific community had to design rigorous, bulletproof tests to completely isolate the human psychology from any actual physical detection.
And they did. One of the earliest massive controlled studies took place in New Zealand in 1948. A researcher named P.A. Ongley designed a sprawling experiment involving 75 separate dowsers.
75 is a good sample size.
Very good. The parameters were strictly controlled to test their ability to detect hidden water. And the final data showed zero accuracy.
Zero.
Zero. Not a single one of the 75 participants demonstrated any ability to find water at a rate better than blind random chance.
Wow. And as the decades progressed, the testing protocols became increasingly sophisticated, right? To eliminate any subconscious visual cues.
Yeah, like the 1991 double-blind study in Kassel, Germany. It featured the famous scientific skeptic James Randi.
Oh, Randi didn't mess around.
Not at all. A $10,000 prize was placed on the table for any dowser who could successfully prove their ability.
How did they set it up?
Well, the researchers buried a series of plastic pipes nearly 2 feet underground across a completely level field. They had a centralized system where they could randomly control exactly which pipes had water rushing through them and which were bone dry.
Okay, that is a fantastic setup.
Right. Around 30 dowsers agreed to the parameters. And in a crucial step, every single participant signed a formal statement before the experiment began, confirming that they agreed the test was completely fair, the conditions were optimal, and they expected a 100% success rate.
So no excuses afterward.
Exactly. Over 3 days, they walked the field. When the data was unblinded, the results were entirely indistinguishable from random chance. The $10,000 prize remained untouched.
Okay, but here's where it gets really interesting. The history of scientific testing isn't just a clean sweep of debunking. There is a notorious anomaly from 1990 known as the Betz study, conducted in Munich.
Ah, the Betz study, yes.
A team of scientists led by Hans-Dieter Betz launched this massive undertaking. They initially screened an astounding 500 dowsers, eventually whittling the pool down to the 43 individuals they deemed the absolute elite experts.
Right, the best of the best.
Yeah. The testing ground was a two-story barn. A water pipe was placed on the ground floor, and it could be moved perpendicular to the flow of the water. The dowsers were positioned on the upper floor, completely blind to the movements below, and asked to track the pipe's location.
And this wasn't a quick test either. Over a two-year period, the team ran 843 individual tests.
And what did they find?
When the dust settled, at least 37 of those 43 pre-selected elite dowsers showed absolutely no ability to find the pipe.
Which you'd think would end the debate.
You'd think. However, Betts and his team isolated the data from the remaining six dowsers. They claimed these six individuals showed results that were slightly better than pure chance. And based entirely on the performance of those six people, the researchers published a conclusion stating that a real core of dowser phenomena could be regarded as empirically proven.
That's a huge claim to make in a scientific paper.
It was huge. But 5 years later, a physiology professor named Jim T. Enright scrutinized that published data and completely dismantled the conclusion.
How did he dismantle it?
Enright discovered that the researchers had engaged in a practice of highly unconventional and customized data analysis. When Enright looked at the raw numbers, the absolute best dowser in the entire Munich study, the crown jewel of their findings, was, on average, a mere 4 millimeters closer to the target than a completely blind midline guess.
Wait, 4 millimeters?
4 millimeters. Across a testing span of 10 meters, the empirically proven psychic ability amounted to a fraction of an inch.
It's like shooting an arrow into a blank wall and then walking up and drawing the bullseye around wherever it landed.
That is exactly what it is. It highlights the danger of manipulating statistical thresholds after an experiment has concluded. Enright also noted a glaring inconsistency. When the data for those six successful dowsers was examined across separate, individual tests rather than aggregated into one lump sum, their performance completely flatlined back to random chance.
So they just got lucky on a few clustered guesses. Imagine sitting at a casino slot machine for 3 days straight, pulling the lever thousands of times and losing almost every penny. But at one point, you hit a $20 payout.
Yeah.
If you took the security footage of the casino, cropped out the 3 days of losing, and published a 10-second video of that single payout, you could claim you had empirically proven a system for beating the house.
That's spot on. That is essentially what the Munich researchers did with their data to manufacture a successful outcome.
But despite rigorous scientific debunking from figures like Enright and Randi, the practice of dowsing did not fade into the annals of history alongside leech therapy or alchemy.
No, it didn't. Instead, it managed to heavily infiltrate incredibly high-stakes, life-or-death modern situations.
Yeah, moving from quirky historical footnotes into genuine modern danger reveals a deeply unsettling reality. Because it is one thing for a neighbor to use a hazel stick to pick a spot for a backyard well, or, you know, for dowsing to serve as a whimsical plot device in pop culture.
Right, like in Coraline or something.
Exactly. But the source material outlines how utility companies and modern militaries have actively deployed this pseudoscience.
The persistence of the practice in the corporate sector alone is staggering. Like in 2017, a public inquiry revealed that multiple major water companies in the United Kingdom were still actively employing engineers who used divining rods to locate underground pipe leaks.
In 2017?
Yes. And the revelation sparked a massive wave of public outrage as citizens realized their utility bills were funding a medieval superstition.
I'd be furious, too. But the military history is even more alarming. During the agonizing trench warfare of the Gallipoli campaign in World War I, a sapper named Stephen Kelly achieved widespread fame for supposedly dousing for water to supply desperate British troops.
Yeah, and it didn't stop there. Decades later, during the Vietnam War, elements within the U.S. Marines were actually trained to use dowsing rods in an attempt to locate hidden enemy weapons caches and subterranean tunnel networks.
Which is terrifying when you think about the consequences of a false negative.
Exactly. Even search and rescue operations fell victim to the allure. In 1986, an avalanche buried 31 soldiers during a NATO drill in Norway, and the Norwegian army actively incorporated dowsing into their desperate search methods.
This historical willingness of militaries to embrace magic during moments of extreme crisis really laid the groundwork for a catastrophic wave of fraud in the 21st century.
It did, because fraudsters started capitalizing on the psychological vulnerability of soldiers facing invisible threats. They began manufacturing devices modeled entirely on the mechanics of the dowsing rod.
And these devices were marketed as ultra-high-tech, sophisticated explosive detectors. They bore official-sounding names like the ADE-651, the SNIFX, and the GT-200.
And these were not just harmless plastic toys sold in novelty shops. They were actively marketed to police forces and defense departments globally.
The U.S. Department of Defense actually procured SniffX rods in 2007. They completely ignored the fact that the U.S. Navy had already run rigorous controlled tests on the devices and proven they were entirely fraudulent.
It's unbelievable. But the most devastating deployment of this fraud occurred in Iraq. The ADE-651 fake bomb detectors became a staple at high-security military and police checkpoints across the country.
Which brings us right back to that scenario at the beginning. Guards were waving empty plastic handles with swinging antennas at vehicles, trusting the ideomotor phenomenon to detect C4 explosives.
And it wasn't until 2016, following a series of horrific mass casualty bombings in Baghdad, that the Prime Minister of Iraq finally issued a direct order forcing the police to abandon the devices.
It's just devastating. This raises such an important question about the architecture of human psychology and institutional failure.
Well, when human beings are confronted with the terrifying randomness of an improvised explosive device or the desperate ticking clock of an avalanche, the psychological craving for agency becomes overwhelmingly powerful.
So what does this all mean? How does a massive, heavily funded modern military bureaucracy possessing satellites, thermal imaging, and advanced ground-penetrating radar end up purchasing a plastic variation of a willow branch?
The answer lies in the visceral nature of the feedback loop. Radar and thermal imaging are essentially black boxes. They require the user to place their trust in an invisible, highly complex system of software and wavelengths.
Right, you're just looking at a screen.
Yeah. But a rod that suddenly swings outward in your own hand, that provides a tangible, physical sensation of discovery. It grants the illusion of immediate personal control over a terrifying environment.
And fraudsters deeply understood this psychological vulnerability.
Absolutely. They took the exact same 16th century ideomotor effect that convinced German miners to dig for silver, wrapped it in black plastic to make it look like modern technology, and sold the illusion of certainty to institutions that were desperate to buy it.
Tracing the lineage of this practice is a deeply sobering experience. A technique born in the pitch-black minds of 16th century Germany evolved into a global phenomenon.
It survived the wrath of Martin Luther, outlasted the decrees of the Inquisition, crossed oceans to the American frontier, and eventually found its way into the hands of guards at modern military checkpoints.
And through all those centuries, across all those continents, the practice was powered entirely by the invisible engine of the human subconscious, amplified by our profound vulnerability to confirmation bias.
You know, understanding the mechanics of dowsing provides such a clear lens through which to view human behavior. If the subconscious mind possesses the raw power to literally force the muscles in our hands to move, and to do so with such seamless deception that our conscious mind genuinely believes a magical external force is responsible, it really invites a deeper self-reflection.
Oh, definitely.
It makes you wonder, what other deeply held beliefs, daily intuitions, or unshakable gut feelings that you experience implicitly are not the profound insights you assume them to be, but simply your own brain's ideomotor response to navigating a chaotic world?
It fundamentally reshapes how we view certainty. The assumption is always that technology provides the ultimate diagnostic clarity. But it turns out the murkiest, most baffling, and most easily manipulated piece of technology discussed today isn't the hazel stick cut from a tree, and it isn't the fake plastic bomb detector.
No, not at all.
It is the human brain holding them.